Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Launched in 2009, the Kepler Observatory was designed to search a part of the Milky Way in the constellation Cygnus to look for exoplanets, planets that orbit other stars. It does so by using the transit method, measuring tiny drops in starlight when planets pass in front of their parent stars. The mission was a tremendous success, but the failure of two of its four reaction wheels caused a cessation of the primary program in 2013, since it could no longer be pointed precisely enough to search for exoplanets. But an ingenious program, dubbed Kepler-2, was announced later that year. The program enables scientists to continue using the satellite's unique instruments to observe and study an even broader range of astronomical objects. Joining us to talk about it are two Kepler scientists. Anne-Marie Cody became interested in astronomy as a youngster and completed a PhD at the California Institute of Technology. She's worked with the Kepler K2 mission at NASA Ames since 2014, where she conducts research on the variability of young stars, as well as managing the mission's data products. Michael Gully Santiago, a.k.a. Gully, is a scientist working with the Kepler K2 Guest Observer Office. He got his PhD in astronomy from the University of Texas at Austin, where he studied the formation of stars and planets and developed optical technologies for telescopes. Gully has conducted scientific measurements with telescopes and laboratories around the world, including space-based telescopes like Kepler. He's fascinated with how modern computing technologies can enhance the pace and reliability of astronomical discoveries. Anne-Marie and Michael, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I'd like to start giving our listeners who may not be super familiar with Kepler an overview. But before we do that, I'd just like to mention that this mission launched in 2009, as I recall, and that was the second year of me doing the first iteration of the show, which used to be called the Blue Dot Report, and it was 4 minutes long. And I remember doing several episodes about Kepler and when the mission started to return science and all the exciting findings of exoplanets. And I just wanted to tell you that I can't believe I'm still reporting on this in 2018.
Yeah, that's right. Kepler is still collecting data right now. It is collecting data, high precision brightness measurements of stars and distant celestial objects. It's continuing that mission right now. So and it's observed hundreds of thousands of objects to date, spanning stars and beyond. So we're very excited.
Well, of course, Kepler is known as the planet hunter. I'd like you guys to explain to us, either one of you or both, where Kepler is in its orbit, because that's kind of interesting. I know it's about 9 light minutes away travel time for communications, as opposed to like the sun's 8 light minutes away, to give people an idea of how far away that is. But I'd like you to give us a sense of where it is in its orbit, why it's in that orbit, and how it works, how it goes about detecting planets, exoplanets.
So, as you said, Kepler was launched in 2009. It's a space telescope. So there are different orbital configurations that telescopes have. You may have heard of the Hubble Space Telescope that actually orbits the Earth. Kepler, in contrast, orbits the Sun just like the Earth, and it's following us. So that's what's called an Earth-trailing orbit. So it's kind of like if you imagine where the Earth is now, you know, some months later, Kepler will be in the same position in space. And that has a few advantages. Sometimes the Earth, which is very bright to a space telescope, gets in the way, and Kepler is able to largely avoid that problem by looking away from both the Sun and the Earth from its orbital vantage point. So it has an unobscured view of the stars and galaxies out there, and it can look at them for a very long time without having us in the way, essentially. Now, the way Kepler works is that it's essentially a big bucket that captures light. It when it looks at a star or another object in space, it's essentially measuring the photons that come from that astronomical object. And it's performing high precision brightness measurements of that star or object over time, repeatedly. And it's it can measure the brightness of a star to something like parts in 1 million, which is much, much better than what we can do from the Earth when you're looking through our atmosphere that's kind of shimmering. And so it's as you mentioned, looking for planets. And I can explain a little more in a bit how we detect those by measuring the star's brightness. And it's also looking for other sorts of fluctuations in the light that allow us to learn about other types of astronomical objects, not just planets.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about this particular observing run, which is called K2 Mission Field 18, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, or Campaign 18, we sometimes call it. That's right.
Okay. It's the 18th, like, observational campaign. Is that the way that works?
Yeah, so after the original Kepler designed field, which is the static field near the constellation Cygnus in the sky, which you can see in the summertime from the northern hemisphere, we observed that field continuously unchanged for almost 4 years, and then because of the failure of two reaction wheels, the telescope was repurposed to look at other points of interest in the sky. And so we've looked at 18 such fields, some of them repeating, overlapping in the sky, but always looking at new distinct astrophysical phenomena. So yeah, we're in 18 presently.
Well, let's go through them in order from nearest to farthest, and I'll just ask you questions, and you can answer them as best you can if my questions are good. My understanding is you're going to be, the closest things you're going to be looking at are like near-Earth asteroids. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so we target asteroids, so both nearby solar system objects by placing down little apertures on our, we only download a fraction of the total amount of data. So we follow the asteroids with these little windows of data download. And in other cases, we just see them go through our pixels, through our little pictures, just by coincidence. And it's sort of funny to see them do that. But yeah, so we will observe asteroids, and we see them all the time.
Yeah, in particular, I would add we're specifically targeting a near-Earth asteroid called Apophis, which a little while back when it was first discovered, people thought was actually in danger of colliding with Earth. We now know that's not going to happen, but it's kind of fun to observe that with Kepler. And like the stars that I mentioned earlier, we're also tracking the brightness over time of the asteroids, and that actually tells us things like, for example, how fast the asteroid is tumbling in space.
So Kepler isn't necessarily searching for asteroids as so much as is studying them, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and what are some of, like, you just mentioned, but what are some of the characteristics that you can learn about that make Kepler a unique observing instrument?
So for asteroids in particular, or for all astronomical
yes.
objects?
Yes. No, for asteroids.
Yes. Yeah, I think the primary quantity is how fast they are rotating, and also the amount of light that is reflected from the sun off the asteroid, and how that fluctuates in time actually tells us about the shape of the asteroids. Are they round? Are they kind of potato shaped? How bumpy are they?
There's also to some extent comets that have been observed, and so in that case you can understand about the ephemeral phenomena as they get closer to the sun and more of their heating occurs and that sort of thing. So there's a variety there that can be gleaned.
And then you're also observing Kuiper Belt objects, is that correct, or objects near the orbit of Neptune?
Yeah, so we observe those sorts of objects. I think Anne-Marie and I are, to some extent, less familiar with those sorts of objects. But in general, you know, the types of things that are interesting from a solar system perspective and that we wonder about are how did these objects get here in the first place? How did the solar system form? How, you know, what is the evolutionary history of the solar system? And to some extent, you can glean that sort of information by looking at what's left in the solar system. So this sort of debris that's maybe been caused by planetesimals colliding in the late history of the solar system formation. So that sort of thing those sort of processes are actually encoded in the distribution of rotation rates and that sort of the frequency of binary asteroids and that sort of thing. And that process of disentangling the formation history from what's encoded in these asteroids is complex and has been built upon for a long time.
Well, and then let's get to my favorite part. I would like to mention that Charles Messier was a famous French astronomer, a comet hunter, and he was hunting for comets and he kept seeing these little fuzzy objects with his little telescope. I believe it was back in the 1700s. And so he made a catalog of them, the famous M objects that are known to amateur astronomers throughout the world. And they're kind of the showcase objects to look at through a backyard telescope or with a nice pair of binoculars. And one of my very favorite things to show people binoculars is one of your targets, M44, the Beehive Cluster. And there's another cluster, I think it's, M67 that you're also studying?
That's right.
And that's called the King Cobra cluster, as I recall, because it's kind of the stars have the shape of a kind of like a cobra. But they're just gorgeous objects through binoculars. They look like glittering jewels set against black velvet. And so really lovely things to look at through binoculars or a small telescope that I've shown people many times over my lifetime. So I'm really interested in what are some of the things that you are going to be studying there in those open or galactic star clusters. Maybe first tell us what a galactic star cluster is.
Okay, so as you mentioned, you know, when you look out at the night sky, there are a lot of stars. Some appear kind of isolated, but then there are groups of them, many of which you can see with your naked eye. And the reason why they're in groups is that these stars are actually, in some sense, bound together by their own gravity. They were born together, and they have stayed there due to their proximity and the gravity that's pulling on each other. Eventually, over many billions of years, these clusters tend to disperse. But early on, most stars, including probably our own sun, were formed in clusters. And so they tend to be typically a bit younger in age than the sun. The sun is billions of years old. And the clusters that you mentioned, for example, the Beehive Cluster is on order of a couple hundred million years old. M67 is actually one of the older ones. But most stars, because they're born in these clusters, looking at the clusters offers us an opportunity to see kind of what was going on early, as early snapshot of what may have happened with our own sun and its neighbors. And there are a variety of questions that we seek to answer, particularly with Kepler. We want to know when and where planets form around these stars, and if it's different in clusters compared to isolated stars. And we also are very interested in understanding how fast stars spin. So all stars, including our sun, rotate about their axes. And there are different physical processes, for example, the solar wind and other stars have this, that affect their rotation rates. And these clusters offer an interesting, in some sense, a laboratory to study stars that are all at the same age. We can usually assume that they're very close in age because they form together, as opposed to looking at any old star on the sky, you may not know what age that star is. But when you're looking at a cluster, they're all kind of a similar population. And so I like to think of it as sort of an analogy with if you want to study a population of human beings, and for example, you want to know what all the young kids are doing, you know, you could go out in public and try to identify young kids, but it'd be much easier if you went to an elementary school. Then you'd have all the young kids in one place, and you could study what they're doing right there. And that's kind of what we're doing with these clusters. We say, okay, we want to know where all the younger stars are and what's happening with them. And so that's why we turn Kepler telescope toward objects like the Beehive and M67.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our interview with Kepler 2 mission scientists Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gully Santiago from NASA's Ames Research Center in Mountain View. Stay with us. And we're back, and thank you for listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Let's get back to our conversation with Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gully Santiago. They're scientists for the Kepler 2 mission that not only hunts for exoplanets, but also studies objects within and beyond our solar system. And what are some of the things that you're most interested in studying about these young stars? I know that you're interested in like star spots that are analogous to sunspots, for example. And stars that are in binary systems are very common, that pass in front of each other. And I would think that Kepler would be uniquely good at studying those. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about the sun, right, you see the sun every day, and you just think of it as providing heat for here on the Earth. But Galileo discovered that the sun is not a perfect platonic solid, a perfect sphere. It actually has these little structures on the sun. They're these relative dearths of flux. They appear black on the surface when viewed safely, of course, through a telescope. And those are called sunspots on the sun. And of course, we see that when you observe the sun over maybe weeks or so, you see that the star spots rotate with on the sun's surface as the sun itself spins. So it's sort of unusual to think, but the sun is spinning. The sun spins once every 25 days or so. Maybe not something you think of all the time, but encoded in the spin is actually we've discovered in through various astrophysical means is actually the age. Stars tend to spin down. Or in other words, rotate more slowly over time. And that rate of decrease of rotation, that actually depends on mass and other factors too, but primarily age is a factor. And that's where Kepler has been truly transformative, because Kepler has enabled us to measure the rotation rates of stars beyond the sun. That had previously been done here on Earth with telescopes like the one in your own backyard. But with the precision of Kepler, we are able to do it for virtually every star we look at. And that's been truly transformative.
And in case we didn't mention, most other stars we look at have spots similar to the sun. But for the younger ones, they actually tend to be quite a bit larger. And it is by looking at the light fluctuations caused as those spots appear and disappear due to these stars' rotation that we can measure the spin rates. And we can do that for thousands of stars in the young clusters and figure out, okay, how fast are these stars spinning at this particular age? And how does that depend on how big the stars are? And then we can go to a different cluster at a different age and see how those spin rates differ and start to come up with physical models to explain what factors exactly affect how fast those stars spin. And it turned out to be fairly complicated in terms of the star's magnetic field and how they accumulate mass over time and then send it back out through their winds.
Well, that, and before I go on, I want to mention that we are talking to Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gulley-Santiago, scientists for the Kepler mission from NASA's Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. You just kind of fired my imagination there thinking about these star spots. And you mentioned that they're very large because these are very young stars. And I'm assuming that these are like sunspots, they're magnetic storms. So I'm imagining there might be exoplanets around these stars that perhaps have magnetic fields of their own. And so they might have just spectacular auroras on these exoplanets.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely possible. I think we talk a lot in our office here about the role of sunspots and how it actually, there's a recent paper came out that actually the, so where are we going, right? So we want to measure, we want to see, are we alone? Is there life out there? What Kepler has done is found all these planets. We know that planets are more common than stars in the galaxy. And the question is, you know, are we alone? Is there life on these planets? And you mentioned aurora. Of course, it'd be great to find not only life on another planet, but one with even more glorious aurora than we have here on Earth. Of course, we're very far from that. But one of the directions that NASA is going is to actually try to measure the atmospheres of planets through the transit spectroscopy method, and that's a method that Kepler is not able to do, but that the James Webb Space Telescope and others in the future will be able to do. But specifically, star spots actually confound that measuring process, and so that's something that I personally have been doing some research on, and it's great because we actually have been able to resolve how, in some measures, how to fix that. So we're not quite at the point of seeing aurora yet. That's still a distant, we think, phenomena. But we do see interaction of planets with their stars, and that's an interesting phenomenon, too.
Yes, and I would add that because of the magnetic fields and magnetic storms, as you mentioned, around these young stars, they also have giant flares that sometimes go off. And that's another area of study that Kepler excels at, particularly looking at these young clusters. We want to know the frequency and the magnitude of these high-energy flares. And ultimately, that may actually have a profound effect on how and when life could potentially arise on planets, particularly those that are very close into their stars. It may be that if a giant flare goes off, it kills off any sort of, you know, life that's forming on the planet, and that really it would affect you know, our search for what's out there.
Kind of like a cosmic sterilizer.
Yes.
Right. UV radiation, not desired.
Yeah. No. Well, of course, Kepler is known as the great planet hunting machine. How many exoplanets has it detected to date, approximately?
So from Kepler alone, we have now confirmed, as of today, just over 3,700 planets. And there's another 1,000 or so that we have stars where we think they're planets, but we haven't fully confirmed what's there. We look at the data and we see something suggestive, but it may be a star companion masquerading as something smaller. So several thousand planets have been discovered by Kepler, and in some cases, there's multiple planets around single stars.
It's fascinating because it wasn't that very long ago that the detection of the first exoplanet was such a huge news event, and now to think we're in the thousands.
That's right. We know statistically that there's more planets than there are stars in the galaxy, and so, you know, what that means to me is that planets are common. We don't know if life is common, but we know that planets are common. That's a key question that Kepler has answered.
And we also know from our own solar system that where there are planets, there are moons, and that in our solar system, some of the most interesting places that NASA's interested in searching for life are not planets, but moons of planets, specifically the moons of Jupiter and Saturn.
Yeah, there's a team actually looking for exomoons, maybe multiple teams, but there's at least one candidate exomoon. It's still being observed and checked for reliability, but it's in principle. Kepler is extremely precise enough such that it could actually discover moons around planets around other stars. So that really stretches the imagination of what's out there. But we know that they're here in our solar system, as you say. We have many moons around other planets here, Jupiter and Saturn and others, and so there's no reason to think that the solar system should be special in its ability to form moons.
And explain to us exactly the method that Kepler uses to detect exoplanets and indeed exomoons. So how does it do that for our listeners that may not be familiar with Kepler?
Kepler serves as a big bucket that collects light from stars and other objects. And when there is a planet around a particular star, if that planet's orbit is aligned with our line of sight such that the planet periodically passes in front of the star, so in a sense it eclipses it, or we call it transits, then what happens when that planet, which is relatively dark, passes in front of the bright star is that the star appears to momentarily become a bit dimmer. Dimming could last a few hours or so, and then when the planet passes behind the star, you don't see it anymore, and you get all of the starlight. Then essentially, if you look at the time series of the brightness of that star at very high precision, you can pick up the dimming events. And they when there is a planet passing around the star in its orbit, these happen at very regular intervals, which corresponds to that planet's orbit. And so in about a fraction of cases where there's stars with planets, the alignment is such that we can detect the planet. So unfortunately, with Kepler and this transit technique, we can't see all the planets out there. We do have other techniques that allow us to find them. But statistically speaking, if we look at a large number of stars, which Kepler has done, it's looked at tens of thousands, then some fraction, a few percent of those stars show planets, and we can figure out from the statistics how many of those stars actually do have planets. So we essentially, through these high precision brightness measurements, we can tell what fraction of stars like the Sun and also other types of stars like red dwarfs have planets. And we can also, we look at many other things, like we mentioned star spots. You can see if there's another star orbiting it, which also eclipses. And we can look at the variability of stars due to dusty material passing in front. So there are many things we can do, but it's all based on this idea that we look at the way the starlight fluctuates in time, and then we can figure out what's causing those fluctuations.
Well, Anne-Marie, you mentioned that you're studying these star clusters, the Beehive and the King Cobra cluster. I love those names. And in terms of our galaxy, they're not terribly far away. How far away are they from the solar system?
Yeah, so we're talking about a few hundred light years. They're not, in astronomical terms, they're not that far away, but they're also not the closest stars, which are just sort of a few light years away.
And they're visible in the springtime sky, as I recall, too, which is kind of neat. You can go out and look at them tonight.
Yeah, so it depends on the particular campaign that our mission is looking at. Sometimes Kepler is looking at stars that you can look at right now, and other times it's actually looking in a different direction, which corresponds to our daytime view. And this is due to the fact that Kepler is in a different place in space than we are on Earth. It doesn't have the same view. So we can't always look at the same stars that Kepler is seeing right now.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the things even farther away that you're interested in, I saw that there's an object called a blazar. Would you explain what a blazar is?
Sure. So in general, we see that So Kepler has observed over 40,000 galaxies. So we live in the Milky Way galaxy. That's our home. And it's sort of funny to think of it, but it's true. Like, we live in a galaxy called the Milky Way galaxy. And almost everything, effectively everything we've talked about so far, resides in that Milky Way galaxy. And not only in that galaxy, but in a relatively nearby sense, and maybe only a tenth of the diameter or so of the entire galaxy is what a lot of folks are looking at with Kepler. But you're right that we've targeted things like these so-called blazars or other phenomena, which are generally related to what's called active galactic nuclei. That's just what astronomers speak for, effectively black holes that are slurping up material in their center. So we've known about active galactic nuclei and blazars and so forth in other galaxies. So we don't think that our own galaxy has one of these intense black hole. We know it has an intense black hole, but it's not slurping up lots of material actively right now in such a vigorous fashion. But we've with Kepler, we've actually targeted these really vigorous, massive black holes. To understand them, we just want to understand more about black holes and about the process of what's going on and how they're related to the material falling in and really how this unusual thing we see that the size of the galaxy tends to correlate with the mass of the black hole, which is sort of weird. So astronomers, some here right in the Bay Area, who we know, Crystalyn Smith, for example, has targeted these and found that you can use the brightness variations of these active galactic nuclei, so it's versions of these blazars, and see and relate it to the physical environments around really close to the black hole, maybe even assess their mass. So that's one example of one of the things that Kepler's doing right now.
That's amazing to me. I'm looking at this, and Anne-Marie, I'm looking at your lovely cartoon artwork that you did for K2 Mission Field 18, which is really fun. You're quite a talented cartoonist.
Thank you.
And I highly recommend our listeners check it out. But looking at the variety of objects that you're studying, from our solar system to, you know, the farthest reaches of extragalactic space beyond the Milky Way, this is almost like, you know, an entire astronomy textbook here that you've got going on.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a big highlight of K2, and it was certainly a draw for me to get involved with the mission, because Kepler originally was an exoplanet mission, NASA's first exoplanet mission. But as Gully mentioned earlier, after 4 years, it experienced a fault in its ability to point. And these wheels that spin around like gyroscopes, one of them broke, and we could no longer point to the original field. But this opened up a whole new possibility that we could operate the telescope in a new mode as K2, pointing at all different sectors of the sky for a few months at a time. And I think it's worth mentioning that the original Kepler mission, I believe it looked at one or two clusters, but it really targeted an area of our galaxy that didn't have clusters, didn't have many young stars. And K2 has completely changed that. And so now we're not only looking at the Beehive Cluster and Messier M67 and some of the other campaigns, we've looked at many other clusters, some that are very, very young in astronomy for stars is a few million years old. We're looking for super young planets in them, and this is an opportunity that's actually unique to the current mission. And so we're not only looking at these clusters, but, you know, as we talked about earlier, asteroids, comets, black holes in faraway galaxies. We're looking for explosions that go off in the galaxies as well. These are supernovae. So it's a vast array of science that we're able to do with this one mission.
We're going to take a short break before we finish our conversation with Kepler 2 mission scientists Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gully Santiago. You're listening to Blue Dot from NSPR. And we're back. Let's listen to the final part of our interview with Kepler 2 mission scientists Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gully-Santiago. They joined us from NASA's Ames Research Center in Mountain View, the home for the orbiting observatory Kepler. And so you mentioned that the inability to point at the original part of the sky, which was in the constellation Cygnus you mentioned earlier in the summer Milky Way. Is it now that you can't point it at all and you basically what it's looking at is what you study, or can you point it in some way?
Yeah, we can select the pointing, but we're restricted. So the way that we resolved this, the broken reaction wheels, we still had two functioning wheels and you need three to point. But some really smart engineers figured out that actually you can use the sun. The sun actually exerts radiation pressure. You can use that to stabilize the third axis in the same way that you stabilize a table with three legs. You can stabilize the spacecraft with two reaction wheels and the sun pressure. So that was phenomenal, and that restricted our pointing to a band of what's the so-called ecliptic, which is familiar to astronomical observers in the backyard. That's where you see the planets go through. And so that's been highly effective. We've covered a lot of that area. We've covered some fields twice, which allows us to see whether changes have occurred over year-long timescales. It's been great. Everyone seems to, well, not everyone. A lot of the astronomers who are interested in the stellar astrophysics specifically have really enjoyed the K2 mission because it gets to target lots of variety.
And how much longer can Kepler continue to observe? Is this going to probably be the last one, or might it go on?
So we're hopeful that it could potentially go through campaign 19. There are uncertainties because, as Gully mentioned, the pointing of the telescope is largely stable when we stay within this ecliptic plane of the solar system. However, there is a small drift of the telescope over time, and to account for that, to stay stably pointed at our targets, we actually have to fire thrusters every 6 hours, and that uses some of this fuel called hydrazine that we have on board the satellite. And every time we fire the thrusters, we use a little bit of fuel, especially for larger maneuvers like when we have to rotate the telescope to send data down after a few months. And so the question is, when are we going to use this fuel up? And we don't have a complete answer. We have an estimate that it could happen any time now. It could happen in a couple months from now. It's difficult to tell because we don't really have a fuel gauge. But unfortunately, there are no gas stations in space. We can't refuel Kepler. So when it runs out of fuel, we will stop observing at that point. But as of now, we have data, we're continuously taking data, and we have so much data that we're going to be mining those images and those observations for years to come. And so in some sense, the mission isn't really due to come to an end anytime soon.
So on its particular interplanetary freeway, the sign says next fuel with an unhappy face emoji.
That's correct.
So I'd like to shift gears a little bit, if we could, to kind of finish things up. And I'd like to find out a little bit about you two and how you got to do what you're doing, because this sounds like really a fascinating mission to work on. So I'd like to start with you, Anne-Marie Cody. When did you first get interested in astronomy? Was it at a young age?
Yes. You know, I have been interested in astronomy for as long as I can remember. At one point, I tried to think back and figure out, you know, when did I first know about the stars and planets? And I think it was actually growing up when I was like 6 years old or so. I just happened to be lucky, and the town that I was growing up in Massachusetts, the middle school there had a planetarium, and we'd go on field trips there, and they'd show us around the night sky in the planetarium and show us where all the stars and constellations were. So I always kind of had in the back of my mind that astronomy was a pretty neat thing. And I didn't consider it as a career until later. But again, Fortuitously, we ended up moving to another town later on when I was a teenager, and it had super dark skies. But not only that, there was actually a observatory in my town run by Harvard University. And through a summer program, I got involved in that observatory, and eventually the astronomers there gave me a key to some of the telescopes and said, hey, you know, you can come over and use our telescopes when you want. You know, don't do anything bad, but have fun. And I thought that was really amazing. And I'm super lucky.
How old were you then?
I first started going there when I was maybe 14, and then I began to come up with science fair projects. So I continued going back all through high school, and then eventually in college I majored in astronomy and went to grad school and took it from there.
And so then after that you went to college and grad school, and when did you become involved with Kepler and Ames?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. My research is primarily on the very young stars, the ones that are a few million years old. And the Kepler mission never looked at any young stars. So for a while, I was fascinated by the telescope and the mission, but I could not find a way to apply it to my young star research. And so I was actually using a different space telescope, or a couple different space telescopes, particularly a French one called Corot, which was similar to Kepler. It's no longer in operation. And we looked at the very youngest stars and measured their brightness fluctuations, looked for planets around them, and tried to understand planet formation, which is something I'm still doing. And then in 2013 is when Kepler had this reaction wheel failure. Everyone thought, oh no, the mission's coming to an end. And then suddenly some engineers, I believe at Ball Aerospace, who work with us at NASA, figured out that if we pointed in the ecliptic plane, the mission could be repurposed and continue operating. And not only that, but we could start looking at clusters, and in particular the very youngest stars that I'm interested in. And so it went from, oh no, Kepler is broken, to, wow, Kepler's finally going to look at the targets that I'm interested in. I just have to find a way to get involved. And so I came to NASA Ames in 2014, and I've been there ever since, looking at the young stars, looking at their star spots, and also the material around them that's left over from planet formation.
Very cool. Wouldn't it be great if you could go back and see 14-year-old Anne-Marie and say, hey, look what you're going to get to do when you're an adult?
Yes, that would be certainly a wild dream of mine at that point. It's amazing how far things have come.
Well, Gully, let's talk about you. How did you first get interested in astronomy?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I was always interested in science in general and math. You know, I guess I was good at math. So, but really the catalyst may have been in senior year of high school when I took the astronomy class with Mr. Emerson. Hi, Mr. Emerson, if you're out there. That was really like the supposed to be the easy class when you're finishing up high school, but actually was just super fun for me. And so that was a catalyst. I decided to major in it in college in Boston, also in Massachusetts. And then I actually got more interested in an aspect of astronomy that may be overlooked, which is instrumentation and device development, so aspects of engineering related to building telescopes. So if you think about it, Kepler is as we've said, a light collecting bucket, and it's a mirror, you know, a large mirror that is focused onto a camera, not too different from what you have in a cell phone camera, for example, a little bit more sensitive. But basically, that sort of technology development is what enables discovery, and that's a big part of what I got involved in, specifically in building different types of optical technologies, both in grad school and at the Jet Propulsion Lab, Micro Devices Lab, and so that was a good intro to me to understand precision measurement, because the devices I made were extremely, had to be extremely precise for them to work correctly.
And when you get together with family or friends that aren't super familiar with your work, what's like the biggest misconception they have about what you do?
Yeah, I guess maybe there's a variety of things. You know, one thing that actually Kepler's played a great role in resolving is, you know, people since the dawn of time have really wondered, you know, where are we from? Where's the sun come from? Where's the Earth come from? How did this come to be? We have a cartoon picture of how that process unfolds, which is that the Earth and all the planets in the solar system form from what's called a protoplanetary disk, but basically just a cloud of dust and gas. And we can't see that process because that occurred in our solar system, you know, billions of years ago. But we can see that process around other stars, and that's partly what Kepler observes. And I guess just the natural feeling that planets and life that's formed here is understood in the sense that we know how we're beginning to get a good picture of how planets form. There's some unanswered questions, and that's where Kepler is playing a role. But we're beginning to get that cartoon picture of, oh, the planets form from the cloud of dust and gas. And that process takes about maybe 5 million years or so. And by 10 million years, there's no more dust and gas. So the planets must have ate up all of that dust and gas. And that's how the planets form.
And what's your favorite part about your work for both of you? Like, just real quick, what's your favorite thing that you get to do?
It might be dorky, but, you know, I really like the data analysis side. I think there's been a tremendous growth of tools built for doing data analysis. I'm really at the interface of taking those tools and applying them to astrophysics. And that's been a great pleasure.
Well, Anne-Marie Cody and Michael Gully Santiago, thanks so much for spending time with us and teaching us all about this amazing mission, the 18th campaign of the K2 mission of Kepler.
Thanks, Dave. It's been a real pleasure.
You know, talking to Anne-Marie and Michael got me thinking about one of my favorite times of the year, the annual Perseid meteor shower, which peaks on August 11th this year. The Perseids are one of the most dependable of the meteor displays, and since they always peak around August 11th and 12th, they're a perfect time to plan a camping trip or perhaps a few hours just laying on your back on a blanket staring up at the night sky in your backyard. And that's the beauty of a meteor shower. You don't need any special equipment, just your warm, moist eyeballs. But there is one ingredient you have to really see a lot of meteors, and that's a dark night sky. So if you live in an urban or suburban area plagued by light pollution, you really won't see very much. But if you can get away from the lights, perhaps up into the mountains, you'll see on average about 60 to 70 meteors per hour. So what exactly is a meteor shower? Why do they have those funny names? And why do they hit their peaks on certain calendar dates with such regularity? And what can you expect to see? Well, to answer those questions, first of all, meteor showers are associated with comets. As comets orbit the sun, they leave little bits of debris in their orbital wakes, kind of like rude boaters throwing out lots of trash behind their boats, and then you run into it when you're trying to water ski. Only this isn't trash, it's basically dust. Little bits of the comet blown off the nucleus by the solar wind. The Perseids are the debris left in the orbit of comet Swift-Tuttle. Discovered in 1862, Swift-Tuttle has an orbital period of 133 years. The last time it reached perihelion, the closest point in its orbit to the sun, was in 1992. Swift-Tuttle has a nucleus about 16 miles across, and it has an orbit that brings it closer to Earth than any other solar system object orbiting the sun. In fact, at one time there was concern the comet might strike the Earth in 2167 when it next returns, but refined observations of its orbit in 1992 thankfully ruled that out, so we won't wind up like the dinosaurs then anyway. They're called the Perseids because if you trace the meteors back to a point of origin in the sky, a point called the radiant, it's in the constellation of Perseus. But you don't need to look at Perseus, which will be in the northeast part of the sky. Just look up. The flashes and occasional bright fireballs can appear anywhere. The best time to watch is after midnight, since that's when the Earth is rotating our night side into the direction of our motion around the sun. Think of it like driving in a snowstorm. You'll see more snowflakes hitting the front windshield than the back. As an added bonus this year, the Perseids peak on a Saturday night, Sunday morning, and during a new moon, which means the sky will be free of interfering moonlight. So if you can get to a nice dark sky, lay out and look up for a couple of hours, you're guaranteed to see meteors. But don't expect them to all come in huge swarms. You may go 10 minutes without seeing much at all, and then see a few, and if you're lucky, some nice big bright fireballs. And here's something cool to consider. If you see, say, 100 meteors on that August 11th Saturday night, if you could collect the actual comet debris that made all those flashes in the sky, they'd likely fit in the palm of your hand. In fact, most of the bits of comet fluff are about the size of a pencil point. It's the flash of light from the meteors burning up at high velocity in our atmosphere that you see, not the actual stuff that makes them. The comet pieces are traveling at about 18 miles a second and get accelerated by Earth's gravity before burning up about 50 to 75 miles above you. So take a friend or family member. The more eyes on the sky means the more likely you will see something. And lay out and watch the cosmos slowly move overhead as you on Earth turn beneath it. If you want to share this episode with someone or check out past episodes, you can find them at mynspr.org. Better yet, subscribe to Blue Dot on NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed via PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Follow me on Twitter at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.